Tonight on Arena, Paddington in Peru, Bird and Blitz are the movies up for review, and Bryce Dessner of The National on being artist in residence at the National Concert Hall. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. On the film reviews this evening, Bears, Birds and Bombs. It's all happening. Big season for Saoirse Ronan fans. Last month we had The Outrun, which is Oscar tipped. Now she's back with Blitz from Steve McQueen, all about a little boy who decides against being evacuated during World War II in London and relies on his wits as he crosses over the war-torn city. We spoke to Andrea Arnold earlier this week, about her new film Bird, which stars Barry Keoghan, Fran Zarkowski and newcomer Nakia Adams. It tells the story of a girl called Bailey. She's on the cusp of adolescence and her chaotic family life and home life is still taking its toll. And brace yourselves, Paddington, the scrupulously polite and accident-prone bear, is taking a holiday to Peru. Where else? Dee Malombe and Declan Burke have been to the movies. They've been eating the marmalade sandwiches and they're with me in studio now. And put down the sandwiches and let's start with Paddington. Seen in the film The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent with Nicolas Cage and Pedro Pascal, I'm sure you've both seen it, where their characters bond over their shared belief that Paddington 2 is in fact one of the greatest movies ever made. Now, that might be a slight exaggeration. I'm prepared to accept that. But it certainly was very enjoyable and hugely successful. So it's hardly surprising that the much-loved bear is back for a third outing. This time round, he's off to Peru to find Aunt Lucy, to visit her and her family. And we get inside the much-talked-about home for retired bears. I mean, what's not to love, even as I say it there? It's such a great old setup. And we all want to hear Ben Whishaw. We all want to hear, we'll hear other voices that we haven't heard previous to this, and we all want to see Hugh Bonneville and all the family back in action, don't we? Or am I alone in that?
Absolutely. And I mean, I don't know if people remember when Paddington 2 came out, but it was such a huge, not just with audiences but critically as well. For a long time it had a 100% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Now I know as a review aggregator, you know, people have their own opinions about Rotten Tomatoes, but I still think that that's an impressive feat, that pretty much every single critic that watched this movie enjoyed it. And a lot of people would kind of say that Paddington 2 is their favourite movie of all time. So it is absolutely beloved. So obviously Paddington in Peru did have, you know, quite a high bar to overcome. For me personally, I still think that this film is an improvement on the first film. Probably ranks somewhere in the middle. It doesn't quite get to those whimsical highs of Paddington 2. But at the same time, I really enjoyed myself watching this movie, going back to Paddington and the Brown family. Just thoroughly absolutely enjoyable.
And seeing them head off to Peru, I mean, it's great that we're going to get out of London. Now, is that a good thing? Can Paddington actually exist outside of London? We know he originated in Peru, but it is quite a task to kind of give him all that lovely polite Englishness in another setting.
It is. Now, he can speak bear, Sean,
of course.
So that comes in very, very useful.
Which isn't subtitled in the film.
Which is not subtitled. So the film starts with a bit of a kerfuffle because Paddington has finally been given a British passport. And of course, he uses it. First thing he does is get out of the country because Aunt Lucy has gone missing, Sean. This is not a holiday. This is a very important mission.
Quest, indeed, that
Paddington and the Brown family are on. And to go back to your question about taking Paddington out of London, I think you're right in terms of what you're intimating here. Does he function? Because the story, as you say, it's a quest where Paddington is kind of our beloved, bumbling, excessively polite bear is obliged to become a kind of a hero, a dynamic kind of character. And he's leading the troops onwards into the dense jungle to find his missing answer. And it doesn't suit the character, in my opinion, as much as I love Paddington. You know, when he's obliged to give these rousing speeches to the troops, the likes of Hugh Bonneville is not that impressed about trudging through the jungle.
Right. Okay.
It doesn't quite sound right.
But he does have to meet some wonderful characters along the way. Olivia Colman, his mother superior, who is straight out of The Sound of Music. Slightly warped Sound of Music, but there she is. She's in charge of the Home for Retired Bears. But also in here comes Antonio Banderas as this character Hunter, and Antonio Banderas as all of his own ancestors as well. That in itself is a bit of fun. And he has a daughter.
Yes, and both absolutely fantastic additions. And I think that Paddington in Peru, the filmmakers obviously knew that it wasn't going to be an easy task replacing Hugh Grant's character in Paddington 2 is just absolutely epic. One of the greatest on-screen villains possibly we've ever seen of all time. And what I love is that Paddington in Peru, much like Paddington 2, ended with a fabulous musical sequence led by
Hugh
Grant.
And be careful, yes, we are going to say that people need to watch the credits at the end of Paddington in Peru, but we're certainly not going to tell them what they're going to see there.
Oh no, all I was going to say but it was that this film doesn't make the mistake of making you wait that long. It features a musical sequence quite early on in which Olivia Colman's Reverend Mother character is singing and dancing about the fact that everyone is so excited that Paddington is coming in Peru. And it's an absolutely delightful sequence. And then, like you said there, we also have the characters of Hunter and Gina, the former played by Antonio Banderas, who is just so fabulous in this movie, so charismatic. Yeah. We see him kind of, you know, roping up his boat with all of these swift, cool moves. And he's just, he's absolutely fantastic.
Get a kind of a Spanish guitar thrill every time he appears, or just every other time
he just feels that way.
Yeah, and he does Spanish, a raised eyebrow and all of the rest of it. Well, here they all are. I think he's on the boat at this stage with the Banderas, and the daughter is there as well. The rest of the crew have gone there. All the Browns are downstairs having a snooze, or below deck having a snooze. And Paddington, it has to be said, is in just a spot of bother in this clip. Of course, it's the voice of Ben Whishaw.
Hello, Mr. Hunter, Gina?
Is it me or is it getting a bit choppy?
Someone be driving? Oh. Gina? Mr. Hunter? Ah, better make an announcement. Good morning. Please could the Brown family pop up to the front of the boat for a slight emergency.
There you go. Actually, Gina and Antonio Banderas, the Hunter, are missing at that stage. They should be driving the boat, but they're not. And therefore, Paddington is in a slight state of panic about the emergency that he finds himself in. The family, the Brown family, the two children are a little bit older. That kind of plays into the story here as well.
A little bit, because they're getting past the sulky, they've grown into the sulky teen stage. And it's one more reason why Mrs. Brown, played by Emily Mortimer, wants the family
tough
to go.
Tough task to follow Sally Hawkins, says Emily
Mortimer. Very much so. And to be fair, the Brown family as a whole kind of fade into the background here. Really, the dynamic characters are Paddington, the Antonio Banderas' character, and Olivia Colman's character, and Wisey, I think, because the three of them have, you know, great charisma and so forth. So that the Brown family aren't really as important to this story as they might have been in the previous two.
And there's a whole bundle of bears that are very important to the story as well. As I say, stay for the closing credits for several brilliant reasons, none of which we can speak about at all. Stars from you on this one, Declan Burke.
It didn't have the kind of subversive message about Paddington in Britain that the previous Paddington 2 particularly had in the wake of Brexit and so forth. I'm giving this one 3 stars.
3 stars. What are you saying, Dee?
I think this has the same feel-good factor and charm that's become synonymous with the series, thanks to that brilliant second instalment. It's a cheesy but touching ending. Like I said earlier, not quite as good as Paddington 2, but very, very enjoyable. 3.5 out of 5 for me.
3.5 marmalade sandwiches out of 5. That's absolutely excellent. We'll have full tummies on that. Let's move on then to Blitz, new film from the artist and Oscar-winning filmmaker Steve McQueen. We're in wartime London. Setting might be familiar. McQueen finds a fresh way to tell the story. He is, Declan, giving us a totally different look at wartime London and maybe showing us the side of wartime, sides of wartime London we don't expect. What's the setup?
So the main narrative of the story is about a young boy called George, played by Elliot Heffernan. The bombs are coming down on London, and his mum, Rita, played by Saoirse Ronan, reluctantly decides he needs to be evacuated to the countryside. And George, when he is halfway to the countryside, decides this isn't for me, and he jumps off the train and he's making his way back to London. So that's the kind of narrative thrust. And then around that, Steve McQueen has woven a number of stories, as you say, about a kind of kaleidoscopic picture of the different races and creeds and colours that all kind of inhabited London at the time, and all their contribution to the war effort. Now, if we look back at the kind of classic war movies, especially about the Blitz, it's you know, we have the stiff upper lip, and it's a very kind of black and white picture of London.
And it's a very white picture.
And it's a very Anglo-Saxon picture. And what Steve McQueen is saying, no, hold on a minute. Those few that Winston Churchill referenced in his famous speech, there was many more. And there was many more that didn't get the credit that they deserved.
Yeah, and in fact, we spoke with him and he spoke about that a lot of the characters that he has put into the film are based on true stories and true characters from historical research into the period. However, as you've said, Saoirse Ronan as a mother, young mother called Rita, a mixed race child, a little boy called, played by Elliot Heffernan. And here's the moment where she's telling him he's going to be sent off to the country, as so many children were during World War II.
Why can't you come with me?
Sweetheart, I told you it's an adventure for children only. Grown-ups not allowed. But it's going to be great. You're going to make new friends.
My friends already are.
Yeah, well, you play games in the countryside. That'd be nice. There'll be cows and there'll be horses.
But they smell. I want to stay with you.
Yeah, I know. It's only until all this is over. And then the schools will open again and life will get back to normal, I promise.
Please, Mum. Don't send me away.
Here. Your dad would want you to have it.
How do you know?
I know because that's the kind of man he was. Because you're his son. And it belongs to you now. And it's going to keep you safe, all right? Yeah?
There you go, Elliot Heffernan and Saoirse Ronan in a scene from Steve McQueen's Blitz. That's a little St. Christopher medal, I think, that she's giving to him at that point, and that turns out to be quite significant, a kind of little emblem throughout the film itself. The relationship between the mother and son is very important in this, but a lot of this film, and Saoirse Ronan obviously pinning the London accent perfectly there, but a lot of this film is on the shoulders of the young Elliot Heffernan, Dee.
I think so. Yeah. It really is Elliot Heffernan and Saoirse Ronan who are carrying this movie. And it's kind of, it really follows like both of their characters. And in a way, neither of them get kind of, well, I suppose Elliot Heffernan probably over Saoirse Ronan would get more screen time relatively, which is kind of interesting because I know that there was talk about Saoirse Ronan possibly being put forward for best supporting actress rather than best lead actress at the Oscars.
Or she'd be the lead actress in The Outrun.
Put her forward exactly for lead in The Outrun and hope that she would get like a nomination there. I think it's probably, having seen this movie, more likely going to happen for The Outrun. But in any case, with Saoirse Ronan's character, she's kind of working in a factory. She's spending time with her girlfriends. She joins this underground network. While the character of George, we see him escape from the train. He's been put on to go to the countryside. He sets on making his way home. He makes friends along the way, but he also manages to make some enemies. And we really find out more about their relationship through not just the present day and that kind of relationship and how they end up separated, but also through flashbacks. We see the context of their relationship and just how close and intimate that bond is.
And when he gets back there, we should say also within the family is Paul Weller playing the granddad, playing Rita, Saoirse Ronan's dad. So there's lots of music and he plays the piano at different points along the way. And also Saoirse Ronan doing some mean singing, which she told us about. She did four or five songs, in fact, but only one of them is in the final cut. But then there's this host of characters, really particularly nasty piece of work played by Stephen Graham, who spoke to us last week as well.
Yeah, Deirdre referenced him in. So what Stephen Quinn is trying to do is give a kind of multicultural but also a diverse picture of London at times. So it wasn't all everyone putting their shoulders at the wheel. Stephen Graham kind of leads up a mob, a gang with Katy Burke as his as a nefarious sister, associate, and they're basically looting bombed buildings and so forth. The most important person that young George encounters, though, is an air raid warden called Aoife, played by Benjamin Clementine. And Aoife is a complete revelation for George. George is mixed race, as you said. Mm. And Aoife is the first black man in authority that young George has ever come across in his entire life.
And again, based on a real character.
And based on a real character. But young George has been bullied and mocked, and he's also been ostracised from. And suddenly he realises, this is part of who I am. This is what I can aspire to be in terms of my heritage. So all these different little interludes that he have on his journey are very, very important.
Does it work on stars from you on this one, Declan?
The two aspects, the boy's own adventure and the multicultural aspect, they don't quite gel for me. Both are very well done and given it 3 stars.
And what are you saying, Dee?
I thought that it really captured the chaos of war quite effectively. Great use of soundtrack, use of silence as well. But I did find that it was kind of failing to make a lasting impact on me once the credits started to roll. So 3 stars for me as well.
3 stars from you. Okay, finally then, on to Bird, latest film from writer and director Andrea Arnold. Newcomer Nakia Adam plays a young girl called Bailey, 12 years old, lots of difficulties at home. Her dad's played by Barry Keoghan, and into her life comes this character called Bird, of the film's title, played by Franz Rogowski. This is another film, I'll come to you first actually on it, Dee. This is another film that had kind of two styles going on within it.
Two styles.
Yeah, there's the social realism of Bailey's life and then this Franz Rogowski character called Bird.
Yeah, and you kind of don't want to give too much away because there is kind of an element of magical realism in it where, let's just say, the title of the movie becomes kind of literal.
Yeah.
But we won't get into that anyway. But yeah, it's an interesting one, and it really does surround this character of Bailey, who on the one hand has this sort of bleak upbringing in a way. We see kind of this dilapidated apartment that she lives in. She learns that her father, whose name is Bug, who is played by our own Irish actor Barry Keoghan, quite brilliantly, is getting remarried. She kind of wants to grow up quite quickly and join this local gang that her teenage brother is also a part of. So she's really kind of looking for connection and a sense of escapism. But then she ends up meeting this
character
of Bird, who's kind of gentle, mysterious, enigmatic, and really quite friendly as
Now, if Andrea Arnold were sitting in this seat, she'd have said to you what she said to me when I talked about the bleak world. She said, no, it's not necessarily that bleak. There are very colourful and lively aspects to this world as well. And I had to take it on the chin when she said it. And let's have a listen to a clip which gives us a sense actually of some of that. The sheer sense of fun, joy and love between the young girl Bailey and her dad Bug, played by Barry Keoghan.
Bailey! Let's go, I'm done. Let's go.
What?
I've got a surprise for you at home.
What is it?
It's a surprise. Yeah. Take this. Oh, careful with that. It's my cash cow, yeah? It's not an actual cow, but, you know. Let's go. Let's go.
There we go. Barry Keoghan and Nakia Adams as Bailey and Bug. Bug is the dad, Bailey is the daughter. And he has this toad with that point along the way, which I can't even try to start to explain, but there's something about the expected that if the slime and the toad can be used as a kind of a narcotic or some kind of...
You licked the head of the toad, Sean. Have you had a very gentle upbringing?
I clearly have never licked a frog in my life. Let's not even go any part further down that road. That aspect of the very strong social realism, and then into it coming this Franz Rogowski character. Rogowski is amazing in this, even though it's hard to pin down his character and we don't want to give too much away about it.
Well, we don't, but you're right, because when he first enters into the story, there's a sinister feel to it, because he's a grown man, strangely dressed, he's got a very strange demeanour, and Bailey meets him first. She's on her own, she's out in the countryside, and you're thinking, you know, stranger danger here. But he is a very gentle and kind and a kind of almost saint-like quality to him as he dispenses his wisdom. And he's there almost as a contrast to the character of Bug, who's you know, he's raucous and he's all over the place and he's just so, and it's as if he's there to give Bailey a sense of there is another way.
Yeah. Bug isn't the worst father in the world though, by any stretch of the imagination.
I know there's two worse fathers than Bug, but Bug comes in third.
And we only see three.
There's no doubt he loves his daughter. He's a bit of a man child. He's never fully grown up. He's certainly not matured. But there's no doubt about the chemistry, and particularly between the two actors, there's a terrific bond between them on screen.
In fact, it has to be said, the performances right around, Nakia Adams, as the, I think this is her first film. There are others in this as well. The guy who plays the brother, Jason Budda, isn't that his name? Mm-hmm. Young performers who give astonishing performances, and then the Barry Keoghan as a senior actor, Franz Rogowski as a senior actor in there as well.
Absolutely terrific performances. I mean, Nakia Adams, I was immediately curious to look her up on IMDb and I couldn't believe that Bird was the only single credit listed there. She's absolutely amazing and she's going to go on to phenomenal things after this. She's just so, so good. Barry Keoghan is as fantastic as always. And yeah, he really is a kind of man-child of a father, and it does become kind of established later on that he basically started having kids when he was a kid. So I suppose that explains exactly why he is so immature. And at one point he, you know, talks about the fact that he's getting remarried as his dream and why can't his child just be happy for him. And meanwhile you have Kaylee, who's his fiance, who ends up kind of getting a like bit of a bond with Bailey as well, which is quite good. She's played by Frankie Box, who is also very, very funny. She wants Bailey for the wedding to wear this absolute disgrace of a catsuit outfit as her bridesmaid, which is this purple sparkly one piece
and
leopard
you'll have to go to it to see if she does wear it. Stars from you overall on this one, Dee?
Phenomenal performances and a really compelling story. Some really interesting things going on stylistically in this film as well. It's 3.5 out of 5 for me.
3.5 out of 5. What are you saying, Declan?
Again, those two distinct styles, as you suggested, the social reason, the mag. I don't think they work together well as. Again, but this is a film that very rarely goes where you expect it to go. Very interesting. The whole way through, I'm going to give it 4 stars.
And it certainly stays with you.
It does, absolutely.
Still thinking about it a couple of weeks later. Okay, that is Bird, the previous two films we were talking about, Blitz, and of course Paddington in Peru. All of them are on general release, and our two reviewers this evening, Dee Malumbi and Declan Burke. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Bryce Dessner is probably best known as a founding member and guitarist of the band The National, a group whose evocative sound has resonated with audiences worldwide and earned them multiple Grammy nominations. But Bryce's talents stretch far beyond rock music. He's also an acclaimed composer with a large catalogue of orchestral works. He has collaborated with a diverse range of artists, from orchestras like the London Philharmonic to musicians like Taylor Swift, with whom he co-produced her acclaimed album Folklore, and contributed orchestral arrangements to her The Tortured Poets Department. He's also worked on film scores, including The Revenant. Now, Bryce joins us ahead of his upcoming residency at the National Concert Hall in Dublin, where he'll be presenting a series of new works, including the Irish premieres of his orchestral pieces Mary and his violin concerto, as well as the world premiere later on of his cello symphony. Absolutely delighted to have Bryce Dessner with us on Arena this evening. And how suitable it is, Bryce, that somebody from The National should be having a residency at the National Concert Hall. But this is a venue with which you are very familiar and I think very excited about being part of the programming there.
It's been a wonderful to have this new opportunity as artist in residence for the National Concert Hall and working with the National Orchestra. We have such a long relationship with Dublin, which is just one of the most incredible music cities in the world. I know people might say that, but it's really the truth. And the National Concert Hall itself is a place that I've had my music performed before, and I've been to see concerts there. And so it's a real honor for me to come across the season several times, and I'll be there next Friday, November 15th. So I'm really, really happy about it.
Yeah, yeah. And the music that's being played on November the 15th, not all your own compositions. You didn't compose Dvorak's Symphony No. 7, but you did compose the Mary piece that we're going to hear and violin concerto, which has been played by the extraordinary violinist Pekka Kuusisto. Let's talk a little bit about Mary, first of all, because this brings us to where you're speaking to us with us from today, to the Basque region in France.
Yeah, at the start of the pandemic, my wife is Parisian and we had been living in Paris, and And we decided to move to the countryside down to, you know, I've been working with two pianists, Katia Marielle Lebec, who will actually be part of the season in April, performing my double piano concerto. And Katia and Marielle are Basque. They were born here, and it's this incredibly beautiful place. Actually, it looks a lot like Ireland, I would say, just beautiful green hills and ocean. And it's, you know, a region with its own language and its own history. And it was one of the last Christian areas of Europe. And so Mari is the goddess of the forest of the Basque, you know, what would have been the Basque religion in sort of pre-Christian times. And there's just these incredibly beautiful old oak forests around here. So it's all oak trees from, you know, 700-800 years ago. They're just extraordinary. So the Mari is my kind of nod towards this beautiful landscape. And the piece is inspired actually by a bit of Dvorak. There's a little thread of the New World Symphony in there. And then also by Mahler, which are two composers I hadn't, you know, necessarily been studying that closely, you know, prior. But at that time, I was really listening quite a lot, especially to Mahler. And so Mari is a kind of pastoral symphony in a way. It's an orchestral piece inspired by this landscape.
I want to listen to a little bit of the opening of Mari. Just a flavour of the opening section there of the orchestral composition Mari from Bryce Dessner of the National, and Bryce is part of the National Concert Hall's big season of his works coming up over the next period of time, and he's speaking with us on the programme this evening. Yes, exactly who you mentioned. We heard Mahler for sure in there. We heard Dvorak, I think, a sense of that in there as well. But the thing that struck me most about the opening of that is the flute, which of course was your starting point, your starting instrument, Bryce.
Yeah, I grew up playing flute. People always ask me how I switched from rock music to classical, and the reverse is actually true. I grew up really playing mostly classical music, and played flute well into my teens, and then picked up an electric guitar, and then kind of switched to classical guitar and studied a composition pretty seriously. And so flute is there's always a lot of flute and cello in my pieces. I think they're maybe my two favorite instruments.
Yeah, because you have a cello symphony coming on, which you're working on. I think that will be a world premiere when it comes with the National Symphony Orchestra. Is that finished and you're polishing it up at this stage, or what is its state of play?
I'm in the middle of it, actually. Yeah, it's a new piece that is, you know, it's really a cello concerto. So it's, you know, kind of like the violin concerto featuring just this amazing young cellist named Anastasia Kovakina. And it felt like to have a new piece as kind of a cornerstone of this residency would be really wonderful. So that was the piece that we chose. And so I'm in the middle of it, and it'll be great for me to hear the orchestra this Friday and really get a sense of what they sound like in the hall to remind me of, you know, who I'm writing for.
What's extraordinary is, as I'm speaking to you now, I feel, this is a very renowned classical composer who's been composing classical music all his life, which is, of course, true. But it is also true that you've been playing rock music all of your life. I don't think even when you were playing flute as a young fella, I think there was probably a lot of rock music and a lot of band playing or song playing going on with your brother Aaron in the background.
Yeah, I think that music was just in the air. You know, my dad was a jazz drummer and, you know, kind of really into the 60s rock music. So we grew up with his record collection, a lot of, you know, amazing records and kind of the usual things you might suspect, like Jimi Hendrix or Bob Dylan. And then my sister was a classical dancer, like dancing in the ballet. So, you know, I first heard Stravinsky's music and Tchaikovsky's music, you know, going to see her dance. And she was also kind of a punk. So we had a lot of really great, you know, post-punk records or things like the Pixies or Sonic Youth, like all that music was sort of just mixing up in the house. We lived in suburban Ohio where there wasn't, you know, loads to do. So we just played music all the time. My brother never really studied formally classical music, but I was very into it. And so it was always kind of that, you know, and I guess the secret of all this is basically, you know, I always had bands with my brother, and then I was always doing kind of more concert work outside of the band. And it's just that, you know, it's always been part of my life and kind of deeply in my DNA.
But are they very compartmentalized then, these areas, because there's more than two areas really of your life. But if we put just key stick with classical versus rock for the time being, are they compartmentalized or how do they link into each other? I mean, when you're working with Taylor Swift, is some of this orchestral stuff coming into your mind and vice versa?
Yeah, you know, you'd be surprised. I always say I don't change, you know, my outfit or my my language or anything. It's not, you know, I'm the same musician wherever I go. And I think that's important also to not put any kind of value judgment on whether something is intellectual or something is pop music or whatever. To me, it's all music and it's all important. And what's the story? You know, what's the story that it's telling? And in a way, song form is the most elemental, you know, form of music. And most of the great classical composers that I love, say Schumann or Schubert, or we mentioned Mahler, they were all great songwriters, you know.
And in reverse then, what does the rock music bring into the classical world for you?
You know, if I'm being honest, the rock music is... you know, if I think about, say, the way Lou Reed played the guitar, or, you know, I mentioned Sonic Youth, obviously the National, we have, you know, 25 years of, you know, living next to loud amplifiers and kind of feeling the physicality of the instruments. And I think that, you know, sometimes we think of a cello as just playing a nice line or a nice melody, but it's also an object. It has a physicality in it. So the cello does all kinds of things related to sound that come out of, you know, textural sounds or, you know, distorted sounds. And I think, you know, sometimes these elements translate into my orchestral music in really interesting ways. And I think, you know, I have a string quartet called a Haim, for instance, that is probably my most performed piece of music. And, you know, in a way it's more rock and roll than any rock music I've ever written in terms of just, it's very aggressive and very fast and kind of loud. And so I think, you know, sometimes it's confusing to say rock or classical. I think, you know, the composer Steve Reich, who's been a mentor to me and someone I've worked with a lot, he says notated or not notated. And I think that's a really good distinction that is part of its language. I think when you work with an orchestra or work with a classical soloist, you're really communicating through a score. And then typically in the collaborations I've had, say in my band, or you mentioned Taylor or Paul Simon, who I worked with, you know, we're not really working through score so much. I'll write a score for the orchestra if I'm doing an arrangement, but in terms of the way we're communicating, it's more by ear.
It's also, I mean, it's an easy kind of classification to make, but I read where you had said about when working with Taylor Swift, one of the things that you really admire about her is the facility to marry the commercial success with the artistic success. There is a temptation in your case to say, oh, well, obviously the high art stuff in the classical world is satisfying that side of him, and the National is touching into his commercial bone. I'm guessing they're not that separate.
I don't really think about it, to be honest. I think that, you know, for me, it's all music I really love. And, you know, a few years ago, I remember when Kendrick Lamar won the Pulitzer for music composition. I thought it was a really just amazing and deserved award. You know, I think that's a good barometer of a way. It was like all this music is of our times. And like I said, the song form is kind of the most elemental form. And it's something that interests me greatly. That doesn't mean that I, you know, sometimes things want to take a walk and go for longer. You know, these songs you're thinking often it's 3 minutes, it's 4 minutes, maybe it's five, or a long song would be 8 minutes. 8 minutes for a concerto is very short, you know, so sometimes it's about form and just having more time to explore an idea and to kind of let the language of the music take shape, you know, evolve how it wants to.
Well, you mentioned the violin concerto. The violin concerto is about, I suppose, 27, 28 minutes long, something like that. Let's have a listen to the opening little section. Thank you. That is violinist Pekka Kosciusko with Bryce Dresner's Violin Concerto, the opening minute or so of it. And the remaining 26 or 27 minutes go at that pace for more or less the entire thing. I was exhausted watching the YouTube version of it today. I can only imagine how Pekka is after he plays it, and he will be playing it in the National Concert Hall. But what struck me about it, Bryce, is you've mentioned Jimi Hendrix. If Jimi Hendrix played the violin, that's the way he'd play it.
Yeah, you know, I think writing a concerto, you have kind of choices to make. And in this case, I really felt Pekka plays a lot of folk music, actually. You know, I think he even loves Irish folk music, but the Finnish folk music, which is a related tradition. And, you know, so that opening almost has a kind of like folk fiddling, just intensity about it, which will hopefully sound great in the National Concert Hall. And, you know, I just wanted the music kind of just opened up, and it felt like this kind of cathartic journey. And, it's kind of an audience piece. People, you know, normally really react to it because it has this intensity the whole time. And Pekka does a fantastic job.
Yeah, I mean, and he has a cadenza towards the end of that first movement that is just astonishing, the kind of solo sounds that he makes within that. But we've been talking about Dublin and we've been talking about the National Concert Hall. We should also mention Cork, because you need to keep the other capital city of this country happy as well. You're very involved, obviously, in that city.
Yeah, about 10 years ago, Mary Hickson, who's one of my closest friends, who at the time was running the Cork Opera House, she asked me about, would you consider starting something here? And so the two of us, we started Sounds from a Safe Harbor, which is this turned into this kind of amazing journey and wonderful festival for all of us. And so it's happening again this coming September. And so I've been to Cork, I don't know, 15 times, and have many friends there. And Killian Murphy's a friend and has helped us. He's helping us curate the festival now. Also, Enda Walsh, the writer. And it's been a wonderful just to connect with all these amazing artists who are from Cork, and that city has a lovely, just sort of charmed feeling about it.
So the collaborations that you like, I mean, they're across not only genres of music, they're across art forms there as well. When you take in the presence of people like Killian Murphy in your work, how important is that kind of cross-fertilization for you?
I really thrive on collaboration. I think collaboration is maybe going back to some of your questions earlier about, you know, the rock music or the classical or some of these sort of more well-known artists. I think it's really, I thrive on interaction with other artists, especially across art forms. So yes, working with a great actor, a great writer, or a film director, or a choreographer, a visual artist, all of these things just, kind of feed me artistically, and just even in terms of, you know, spending some nice time with people. It's wonderful to, you know, the life of a composer can be pretty solitary. And I think that the kind of idea, the 20th century sort of myth of these sort of solitary geniuses that show up with their score and, you know, just deliver greatness in that way. I think it's a myth. I think it was always a myth. You know, I don't think any of us exist in isolation, and all musicians are connected and all art forms are connected. And, so it's that's a big part of kind of why I do these things.
And of course, you have also composed film scores, not least of a part of the score for The Revenant. Is it a very different process writing for the screen and for a finished visual article than it is to write, you know, a more open orchestral piece like the Violin Concerto?
I think, you know, maybe film music is a little bit like writing an opera, where there's a scene and you're interacting with the scene in terms of how does the music serve the narrative. I always say, you know, what is a good film piece, you know, is quite minimal. It can only take, you know, when I worked with Iñárritu on The Revenant, or more recently on Bardo, he always says, it could be one note, maybe two notes, probably not three. And it's, you know, we're obviously in a concert setting, like you said, the Violin Concerto has a million notes, you know, but that, you know, usually a piece like that would not sit well in a film because it would dominate too much. But you know, it's like Iñárritu, he also says, you know, if I'm pointing at the moon, don't draw my finger, which I think is a good example of, you know, I think film, when it's good, is just this incredible playground where you're working with hundreds of these amazing collaborators. And it often forces me to kind of find new things I wouldn't normally have done. And I find that exciting. It could be bad too, to be honest. You know, if you're working on a film that you don't enjoy, or, you know, sometimes taking marching orders from a director can be hard. I actually recently worked with another great Irish artist, John Crowley, who directed We Live in Time, which is a new film that's just out now that I did the score for. So that was quite fun.
All right, yeah. So we'll be looking forward to seeing that, I think, a little, either later this year or early next year, perhaps. Bryce, thanks so much for being with us this evening and the best of luck with the entire residency.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's so wonderful to speak with you, and I'm so excited to see everyone next Friday in Dublin.
That's Bryce Dessner, and Bryce and his music are a major part of the National Concert Hall's 2024-25 season. Six major works by him will feature in three concerts between this month and April of next year, the first being on Friday the 15th of November, as we've been hearing there with the National Symphony Orchestra. Irish premiere of both the violin concerto, written and performed by the star violinist Pekka Kuusisto, and his orchestral work, that's Bryce's orchestral work, Mari. We'll also hear Dvorak's Seventh Symphony. An added bonus with this concert is a post-concert talk with Bryce Dessner, with André de Ridder, and with the violinist Pekka Kuusisto as well. Full details of Bryce's performance on nch.ie. From Eden is an award-winning play by Stephen Jones in which two lost individuals find themselves locked in a bathroom together at a New Year's Eve party. Sounds like a nightmare. Alan and Eva are played by Rex Ryan and Jordan Jones in this new production of the play for Glass Mask Theatre, which is directed by Jed Murray. Delighted that Jordan Jones and Stephen Jones are with me in studio now. No relation, we should point out.
Not that we know of.
Yeah. No, we're part of the wider clan.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, the Joneses, yeah. People keeping up with us.
Exactly that. Setting a play in a bathroom with two people locked in is one thing, Stephen. Setting it in a bathroom on New Year's Eve is, you're up in the stakes there. Situation and time. Good setting, good point to do something New Year's Eve, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah, because it always sparks a bit of a debate. Some people love it. People like myself, not a big fan of the, as they say in the play, the organised fun, the kind of pressure that you have to give me a random Tuesday night and I'm happy. New Year's Eve, not so much. So, yeah, I just thought how to get two characters into a room for an hour with kind of bigger stakes and a party in a bathroom that's under renovation. So everyone else in the party is using the downstairs loo so they can't be interrupted and... They both are hiding away from this party for specific reasons, which is a bit of the mystery of the play.
Yeah.
And but yeah, sort of neither one wants to go down and mingle for their own reasons yet. And yeah, so they're forced to kind of talk to each other. And when that happens, you know, that's where we get drama.
Yeah, and Alan and Eva are the two characters. Jordan, you're playing the character of Eva in this particular one. One of the difficulties about talking about this play is the both characters slowly reveal bits about their past. Mm-hmm. We certainly don't need to go into any of that in detail because it'll spoil it for everybody. But how would you describe the character we meet in this play? Because she's very clear in some ways at the beginning and she's hiding loads.
Yeah, exactly. So when I first read it, I was like, I've met Eva. I've met lots of Evas from growing up in Talla. Specifically, I think, because I think, you know, people from an area like Talla, you know, because she is like a working class woman, can kind of have this kind of like intimidating but also endearing nature. Like, you know, they have this hard exterior around them. They'll kind of poke fun at you and slag you. And if you don't understand it, you might take it up the wrong way. But underneath it all is like a very sensitive person with lots of love and a big heart. And I think being stuck in this bathroom is kind of a way to kind of see that.
Yeah.
In the end.
Yeah, and Alan, see, equally. Now we should point out you did play Alan in the original production of this play back in the olden times.
Yes,
Stephen. But it's Rex Ryan who's playing Alan this time around. But Alan, they're from similar backgrounds. In fact, that they're both kind of linked in some ways by. The Eva's friend is getting married, and Tom's or what's his name?
Alan's brother.
Alan's brother.
Yeah, so the hosts of the party are connected to them both, but they don't know each other.
Yeah.
And Alan, I think it's okay to give this little spoiler away because it comes early. Alan has been missing.
Yeah. For a period of time.
You know, in
around
one year.
Time of the wedding. Yeah.
Yeah. For a number of years, and has recently come back onto the scene. so would have never met Eva, but certainly is, you know, is aware of what's going on, and is kind of socially awkward and hiding away with his bottle of wine. And while they're from similar worlds, there's maybe a sense of Alan having a bit more notions, maybe is the word.
Yeah, a little bit superior betimes, is he?
At times, yeah, you know, but very much pulled back to earth by Eva.
Yeah.
And they make a kind of a funny odd couple. But yeah, that's the thing. It's I wanted to have a piece that would have these kind of dramatic and tonal shifts the whole time, and you know, be funny and humorous and be kind of like a fly on the wall for an audience, and yet at the same time underneath to talk about these bigger things like family and religion and faith and mental health, and all of these things are in there, but hopefully...
Yeah, because let's reiterate, the play is called From Eden.
Yes.
And the two characters are Alan and Eva.
Yes.
So we can see certain parallels there,
yeah,
for sure. But it does strike me, Jordan, this really, it's a two-hander. Everything's happening downstairs and we can hear music from downstairs. In fact, it's a Hozier song that we hear, From Eden, we hear that playing at one point downstairs as well. But a lot of it is about the electricity and the chemistry between the characters of Alan and Eva. How have yourself and Rex Ryan been exploring that in rehearsals?
Well, I think the characters themselves are just like the perfect personalities to be put in front of each other and kind of just bounce off each other in a way that just like creates something really interesting. And yeah, in terms of like how we've been exploring it in rehearsals, I just think, sorry.
Saying the words probably, because a lot of it is on the page. There's the chemistry is there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes with a play like this, and I know from doing it, even though I wrote the thing, you sometimes have to get out of its way and just do it and keep it simple. And then it surprises you in the moment with something that's maybe a little bit more complex or hopefully a bit more depth. Or something that shouldn't be funny that is funny, or even the pauses and the silences of two people in a room and the gender politics of that, where, you know, they don't really know each other and why are we not leaving here?
Yeah, because I mean there are times in it when you get a little sense that perhaps is this a slightly dangerous situation for either or both characters to be in. There's a bit of that going on.
Yeah,
Jordan,
definitely, because it's about connection, but then once something is revealed about the other person that they don't know about, sometimes that connection can kind of drop because you're like, oh, wait, who are you or what's going on or whatever? Mm. And then it's about them having to like pick that back up again. And, you know, it's kind of like a ball that they're passing between each other in that sort of way.
And the energy that, I mean, because this is a stage production, I had heard there was a radio production of this as well, which is a very different kettle of fish, obviously. The physicality of being kind of cramped into this small space, I presume that's part of the claustrophobia of the piece.
Oh yeah, definitely. That's what runs the whole thing. That's what keeps us up. Yeah.
You, Stephen, now I hope you've treated both Jordan and Rex gently in this one. You're the writer of the play, which is always an intimidating moment for any actor when the writer's in the room. It might be a helpful thing, but it's intimidating sometimes too. And you had played the part before. So how hands-on, how hands-off have you been?
No, hands-off. I was there for the first read-through and I know Rex and Jordan's work from before, and so I knew it was in safe hands anyway, but then I heard the first read-through and I just thought they got it straight away. And Jed Murray's directing, who's he couldn't have a safer pair of hands. So I was there on the first day to kind of answer any burning questions or give any little bit of insight, and then I stepped away because as much as I would like to be neutral, I think, I would hate to have any sort of stamp from my production put on this. I'm kind of just excited to show up on opening night and see what the guys have done.
See what they've come up with.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing the energy in something like this, stage piece with two people, very different from a screen piece where you've a lot more moving parts and usually a lot more people involved, Jordan.
Oh yeah, I've realised that it's a completely different ball game altogether and a lot more mentally challenging as well to stay very present throughout the whole entirety of the play, which has been the challenge. I've been just really appreciated that I really got to, do that.
Yeah, because
that experience.
We were trying to remember when we were last talking.
Yeah.
I think we may have spoken around the time of You Are Not My Mother. Did we speak around the time of that film? Do you remember?
Might have.
Yeah, and just remind us of that film and how different this is from that style of piece.
Well, I think you can stop and start during film. You can say, let's do that again. Where when you're on stage, you can't kind of do that. And I think it's like your mind is almost like can be split as well of like, you know, not having to pay attention to the audience, not worry about forgetting your lines and just really being in the moment and listening to the other character. Whereas I feel like with film, it's a bit more relaxed in that sort of way. So, yeah, completely different ball game, but I love the challenge of it.
And it's great for me. I get great joy out of dragging these film stars back to the back to the theatre, you know?
You've been going in the, or have gone in the opposite direction a little bit as well with your play, Northern Nights.
That's right,
Stephen.
Yeah. That was another two-hander that I wrote, and thankfully it got picked up by Deadpan Pictures here in Ireland and Lionsgate in America and various other funders and countries. And so, yeah, it's a six-part TV series which has been out now for the last year, and people can still watch it on the TG4 player. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's provided a few more opportunities in on that side of things. So
and moving, taking something from the stage to the screen like that, was it a big change?
It was. It was something that I didn't think that particular play would be able to do, but it was the producers who kind of came knocking on my door and they said, we want to keep the heart of the story but expand that world out, and how would you do it? And they, you know, gave me a bit of time and, you know, a few quid to go away and think about that. And yeah, it was certainly a challenge, but I had very good people around me, and you learn a lot when you're thrown in at the deep end, you know.
Just one final point that I think you wanted to talk a little bit about. A little bit of a health challenge you had recently, but thankfully you have overcome.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, I turned 39 this week, but so 3 months ago, I had an ischemic stroke, totally out of the blue, really, coming out of a gym, which I always say it serves me right for trying to be fit. But thankfully, I had the wherewithal to ring an ambulance and go to St. James's, who took great care of me. And yeah, very lucky that I didn't sustain any major physical damage. But the reason, like, it helps me to talk about it, but also it's like the old rule in theatre. There'll always be someone in the audience who needs that show that night. And there'll be someone in your audience tonight, Sean, listening to this, who is struggling, maybe a stroke survivor, someone with cancer or mental health, anything, a number of conditions that people go through. And so maybe they need to hear, just, you know, keep going.
Keep going. Well, nice thing to share with us, Stephen, and thanks for doing it. That's Stephen Jones and Jordan Jones, still no relation, to quote Micheál O'Meara-Cartey at some point along the way. From Eden is the play that they've been speaking about. It's at the Civic Theatre in Talla from the 19th through until the 23rd of November at the Bestseller Cafe, Dawson Street, 41 Dawson Street, Dublin 2, from 9th to the 19th of December. And it's a glassmasktheatre.com production. You can find out details on glassmasktheatre.com and civictheatre.ie. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy were the researchers this evening. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Harry Bookless was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will be back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.